All right, so you're here with us on the deep dive because you're ready to really get down to it and grasp these crucial legal cases. And I know, especially for all you law students out there, it can feel like drinking from a fire hose sometimes. So think of this as us giving you like the cheat sheet to get right to the heart of things.
Exactly. Yep.
Today, we're tackling Katz v. Oak Industries, Inc., that 1986 Delaware Chancery Court decision that's like required reading if you're going to understand what happens to bondholders when the company's going belly up.
Absolutely.
What's so fascinating about this case to me is that it really lays bare this tension, right, between what a company is legally obligated to do and just what it needs to do to flat out survive.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Katz is really grappling with this raw question of how far can a company go when it's in dire straits to restructure its debt, even if it means kind of squeezing the bondholders into a corner and maybe making them take a less than ideal deal. It really highlights that clash between the rigidity of contracts and the brutal realities of, the financial world.
Okay, so before we get too deep in the weeds, let's set the stage here. Oak Industries was in a world of hurt. We're talking losses exceeding $335 million between 82 and 85. Their stock price just totally tanked, went from $30 a share all the way down to a measly $2.
Oh.
Yeah, not pretty. So they came up with this restructuring plan, two big moves, sell off some assets to Allied Signal. That was a major step. And then they wanted to cut their debt by a whopping 85%. And the way they were going to pull off that debt reduction, that's where this case really comes into focus. It's all about this exchange offer they made to their bondholders.
Now, the key thing to wrap your head around here with this exchange offer is how it was set up. Oak was basically saying to these bondholders, look, we'll give you new bonds, okay, and they're going to be worth less than what you're holding now on face value, but hey, it's still more than what those bonds are currently trading for out there in the market. And this is a big, but there was a catch.
Always a catch, right?
Right. To get this new deal, the bondholders had to agree to give up some pretty important protections that were baked into their original bond agreements, what are called the indentures. Think of the indentures like the fine print in any loan agreement. It lays out the lender's rights. So these protections, they might include things like limits on how much more debt the company could take on rules about selling off key assets, stuff like that.
And this is where it gets really juicy. This wasn't just a simple take it or leave it situation where it only affects the people who opt in. Oak put in this clause that said if they got a big enough chunk of bondholders, they were talking 85%, to agree to this exchange and to give up those protections, then all the bondholders, everyone will be bound by those changes.
Exactly. And that's what brought Moise Katz into the picture. He was one of the bondholders, and he basically said, hold on a minute, this whole thing feels like a shakedown. He argued that Oak was essentially strong-arming everyone into making this choice between accepting a deal that wasn't what they signed up for or running the risk of getting even worse terms if a huge number of the other bondholders went along with it. He felt like they were being backed into a corner without any real choice.
So that sets the stage for this legal battle.
Yeah.
What were the big legal questions the court had to grapple with?
Well, the court really had two main issues to sort out. First off, was this exchange offer, especially with that provision about getting rid of the bond indenture protections if enough people signed on? Did that amount to illegal coercion? Was Oak unfairly pressuring its bondholders? And then the second question, which is really closely tied to the first, was did Oak, in the way they went about this whole thing, violate what's called the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing? That's like this unspoken agreement that exists in every contract, including these bond deals.
Right. So let's break down that first big question, the coercion issue. What did Chancellor Allen ultimately decide?
So Chancellor Allen came down on the side of saying that Oak's actions didn't actually meet the legal definition of illegal coercion. His reasoning was interesting. It really came down to just how bad Oak's financial situation was. The court basically said, look, we get it. This offer isn't great for the bondholders, but given the mess Oak is in, it's actually a pretty reasonable deal financially. And here's the key point they emphasize that the bondholders still technically had the choice to reject the offer. Sure, there was that risk hanging over their heads that if enough other people took the deal, their own protections would be weakened. But the choice, however unappealing it might have seemed, it was still there. So the court's position was essentially, hey, market pressure, that's not our problem as long as you technically have a choice. The pressure Katz was feeling that coercion is really stemming from Oak's financial troubles, not some illegal move by Oak and how they structured the offer.
That's a really important distinction, right? The pressure was coming from the circumstances, the economic realities, not from some illegal act by the company itself. Now, what about that second big issue, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing? That seems like it could be a bit more open to interpretation.
You're right. On that second question, the court really honed in on the basic relationship between a company and its bondholders. Chancellor Allen was very clear that this relationship is governed by contract law, not by the more stringent duties that a company owes to its shareholders, you know, those fiduciary duties. The implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, what that's there to do is to protect the reasonable expectations that both sides had when they first entered into the contract. It prevents one side from doing something that, while maybe technically allowed by the letter of the agreement, completely undermines the spirit of the deal, what the other side thought they were bargaining for.
So in this specific case, the court didn't think that Oak had crossed that line.
No.
That's right. The court reasoned that Oak's exchange offer, it was available to all the bondholders equally, and it followed the specific rules spelled out in those bond indentures, especially the part about how the agreements could be amended with a majority vote. They used a really clever thought experiment to get at this. They asked if the people who originally drafted these bond agreements had sat down and specifically considered this kind of scenario, a company on the verge of collapse, making an exchange offer tied to getting consent to change the rules, would they have explicitly prohibited what Oak was doing? The court figured that the answer was probably no. The fact that there was already this built-in mechanism to change the agreement with a certain level of bondholder approval that suggested that this kind of move wasn't totally out of bounds, especially given that Oak had a legitimate need to try to avoid bankruptcy, which, let's face it, would probably have been a disaster for everyone involved, including the bondholders. I mean, imagine if Oak had, like, straight up lied about their financial situation to trick the bondholders into taking the deal. That could have been a breach of good faith, but that wasn't what happened here.
Makes sense. So it wasn't about whether the offer felt fair on some subjective level, but whether it actually violated the rules of the game, the rules that everyone had agreed to, or whether it went against the reasonable expectations that came from those rules. And this brings us to some of the really crucial language from the case. What are some of the quotes that really capture the court's thinking?
There are two quotes that really jump out. The first one comes from Chancellor Allen. He said, "The terms of the contractual relationship, not broad concepts such as fairness, define the corporation's obligation." That really drives home the point we were just talking about, right? For all you law students out there, this is a major takeaway when you're dealing with contracts, especially in the business world. The specific language, the terms that were hammered out, those are king. Courts are generally not going to swoop in and impose their own ideas about what's fair if the contract itself hasn't been broken.
That's a pretty clear message.
Yeah.
What's that second quote that we should have on our radar?
The second really important one is this: directors must maximize shareholder interests within the law, even if it harms bondholders. Now, I know that might sound a little rough at first glance, but it gets at a fundamental principle of corporate law. Creditors, like bondholders, they know they're taking on a certain level of risk when they lend money to a company, right? They're doing it in exchange for a fixed return. The fact that a restructuring might end up benefiting the shareholders more than the bondholders, that doesn't automatically mean it's unfair or a breach of duty. As long as the directors are playing by the rules, operating within the legal framework, and fulfilling their obligations to the shareholders, it's all good. The court drew a clear line in the sand. Bondholders, they're creditors with contracts. They're not shareholders with inherent rights to the company's loyalty.
So what kind of ripple effects did this ruling have? How did Katz v. Oak Industries really change the landscape of corporate restructurings?
Well, one of the most significant outcomes of this case is that it basically gave companies the green light to use what are called exit consents. This is exactly what Oak did, right? They linked the offer to swap out the old bonds for new ones with this request that the bondholders agree to changes in the original bond agreements. Katz essentially gave this practice legal legitimacy, and it became a really common tool in restructurings. It made it a lot easier for companies in financial distress to rejigger their debt because they could offer new terms and at the same time get rid of those pesky clauses in the old agreements that were holding them back. Katz provided the legal foundation for all that it made exit consents an indispensable tool when companies are in a bind.
So did this ruling essentially give companies free rein to just do whatever they wanted to bondholders during a restructuring?
Not quite. While Katz opened the door for exit consents, it also set some important boundaries. The court was very clear that these offers still had to make financial sense given the company's situation. They couldn't discriminate against certain bondholders, and critically, they couldn't go against the specific terms laid out in the original bond indenture agreements. There had to be a basis for these actions within the existing contractual framework.
So for all our listeners who are hitting the books in law school, what's the big takeaway from Katz v. Oak Industries?
The key lesson here is that the language of the contract, the actual words on the page, that is absolutely paramount in situations where a company is in serious financial trouble. Unless there's very clear evidence of bad faith, think about things like manipulating the vote on the exchange offer or deliberately hiding crucial information from the bondholders, courts are generally going to stay out of it. They're not going to second guess the terms that were negotiated in a restructuring, even if those terms seem kind of raw for the creditors in hindsight. The courts are focused on upholding the agreements that the parties made themselves.
And it sounds like the court also took into account the real-world consequences of their decision.
Oh, absolutely. The potential fallout from the ruling was definitely a major factor. If the court had sided with Katz and granted that injunction, it probably would have torpedoed Oak's whole restructuring plan and potentially pushed them straight into bankruptcy. The court recognized that that outcome would have been bad news for everyone involved, including the bondholders themselves. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to make tough choices, choices that might seem unfair to some people in the short term, but they're necessary for the long-term survival of the company, and that ultimately can be better for a wider group of stakeholders.
So to sum it all up, Katz v. Oak Industries, it really underscores this fundamental idea when a company is struggling financially and needs to restructure its debt. The rights of the bondholders, they're primarily determined by those contracts they hold. And while there's this implied expectation of good faith, courts aren't eager to jump in and meddle with restructuring efforts, especially when those efforts are driven by a real need to stay afloat as long as they're operating within the agreed-upon rules, treating bondholders fairly in the process, even if the end result isn't a win for everyone.
Precisely. It really highlights that contractual foundation that underpins these relationships and the limits on when courts will step in when companies are trying to navigate those choppy waters of financial restructuring.
This case really gives you a lot to ponder. And given how much emphasis Katz puts on those contract terms, it makes you think, how should bondholders and their legal teams approach drafting those bond indentures in the future, right? How can they better protect themselves if a company runs into trouble down the road? What specific clauses or mechanisms could they build in to try to balance out that power dynamic that comes into play when you're negotiating a restructuring? It's a question worth keeping in mind as you move forward in your legal careers and dive deeper into corporate finance and the world of creditor rights.
Definitely. It encourages a much more proactive and strategic approach to how these agreements are crafted from the very beginning.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Katz v. Oak Industries. We hope this has given you a much clearer grasp on this landmark case and its lasting impact on corporate law.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
Until next time.
See ya.
Keep diving.